MacCast, Sunday, December 22nd, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Happy holidays. Welcome to the MacCast. Yep, we've got Christmas right around the corner. It is holiday time, and we're back here for another podcast. Hopefully, you're off enjoying a vacation break, spending some time with family and loved ones. I am going to be working a little bit, but also having some fun too. We'll get some family time in there. And of course, the Apple and Mac news does not stop when the holidays are going. We have quite a few things to talk about this week here on the MacCast. We're going to talk about selling past peak iPod. Yeah, that's a thing I didn't really know, but we'll explain what that is and what's going on. Also, Apple acquiring some more artificial intelligence technology. Talk about a potential bug that could allow your kids past your parental controls in iOS. Counterfeit iPhones showing up from an unlikely source. Also, Apple is getting a lion's share of smartphone profits still. We'll talk about that. Some Apple TV stuff. Also, is Apple going into space? And that will round out the news in this episode of the MacCast. Then we're going to talk about pricing on that Mac Pro. Is it crazy or is it not? I have some thoughts and opinions based on some things that I read over the past week or so. We'll also give you some tips on saving some money on some of your Apple services and maybe getting some Apple services for free, and then try to help out a couple listeners with a few questions and help you out with a possible issue with that could crop up in some of your Christmas videos thanks to a listener. So it should be a great episode. Hang on. I think we're just going to dive right in. Want to start off talking about peak iPod. Yeah, it's a thing. I guess apparently the highest quarterly point of iPod sales, so the most iPod sales in terms of revenue ever, has become some sort of measurement, I guess, of the current success of other Apple products. I guess in a way, it really does make sense. iPod was a huge product for Apple, really one of those things that Steve Jobs brought in and turned around the company, brought in things like iTunes and now Apple Music. So it certainly was a foundation for the future of the company. And I think a lot of the thought of iPhone came from iPod as well. So they call it peak iPod. It actually happened in 2007, where iPods were generating $4 billion in quarterly revenue, and now they're measuring other Apple products up against that bar. And guess what? There are now two products that have or will soon supposedly surpass peak iPod, and they may or may not be the products that you think, or they could be. Asimco, in a research note, thinks that AirPods could actually surpass peak iPod revenue next quarter. It's hard to actually estimate AirPod sales because Apple lumps those in a single category with wearables, home, and other products. They don't break out individual numbers for individual products anymore. So what Asimco did was they crunched the numbers by estimating and subtracting what they believe Apple Watch sales are. And so they think by next quarter, AirPods could surpass $4 billion in revenue. Also this week, another interesting number came out from another analyst, Tony Sakanagi, over at Bernstein. He says he believes that AirPods generated about $6 billion in revenue in total in 2019. So if they are going to surpass peak iPod in a single quarter next quarter, that would mean Apple would be ramping up sales in 2020 or actually really have a great holiday quarter, which I no doubt AirPods are going to sell really well this holiday season, but that would be a big difference. $6 billion in all of 2019 versus doing $4.25 billion. So again, a lot of these numbers are being guessed at. Could it happen? Will it happen? We will only find out when we hear numbers from Apple's quarterly sales numbers and also the first quarters or first couple quarters of 2020. But Sakanagi thinks in 2020, AirPod sales will be up significantly, going from $6 billion in 2019 all the way up to potentially $15 billion in 2020. And then the other product that already has passed peak iPod and seems to be growing even larger is the Apple Watch. So both products passing peak iPod are wearables. And this, again, with numbers from Asimco data, they say that Apple Watch saw a 51% revenue increase year over year. That means in this holiday quarter, they're predicting Apple Watch to exceed the $4 million peak iPod revenue amount and bring in an estimated $5.2 billion in revenue. So pretty nice numbers for a couple of newer products in Apple's lineup. And it's nice to see this because Apple often doesn't get a lot of credit for these products. Everybody seems to pay attention to Macs and iPads and iPhones. And it's hard to forget that they have these accessories that are doing very, very well in their own right as part of the company's revenue stream. And one other little odd thing, since we're talking about AirPods right now, that came up, and this came in from a tweet from Federico Vitici from Mac Stories, and actually it was based on some posts in a Mac Rumors forum thread. There's a number of people that are saying the AirPods Pro have kind of a distinctively sweet bakery type smell. They're saying actually, or I guess it's more fruit, but also I think of muffins. They're saying their AirPods Pro smell like blueberries. There's a number of people saying this, and I have to admit, when I heard this, it did make me pull out my AirPods and take a whiff of the AirPods. I know, a little strange, but I have to tell you, I got a hint of it. I think they might not be crazy. We don't know why they maybe smell like blueberries. I'd be curious to know if yours do. Where I think it's coming from is I think it's the new silicone tips that are doing it. So that's just my theory. I think that's generating the little kind of sweet smell of AirPods Pro, but just something weird that I read about this week. Apple has reportedly acquired some new AI technology to help with its photography efforts. According to Bloomberg, Apple has acquired a UK-based photography company called Spectral Edge. The company has developed an algorithm to enhance low-light images in real time. And the way the technology works is it uses an infrared shot and then combines that with other exposures to create a crisper image with better color accuracy. The company's CEO says that it will also help with bokeh processing by eliminating artifacts. As you know, Apple has been getting more and more into what they call computational photography, so trying to do more with their A-series processors and their image processors inside the iPhone, and also leveraging artificial intelligence technology and machine learning to make their images better. So it makes sense that they would want to acquire this kind of company. Very often they'll do this not only for the technology itself, but also for the engineering talent at these smaller organizations. We generally don't get any comment from Apple on these acquisitions beyond the fact that they acquire companies from time to time. And on this one, there was not a lot of details on potentially the price that Apple paid for the company. But for you and me, the flip side and the good thing is it means that our iPhone photos are just going to get better and better over time. Another little story in the acquisitions area that might be happening: Apple supplier Broadcom is looking to sell its RF wireless chip unit. This is according to the Wall Street Journal. Broadcom's RF unit makes filters that are used in smartphones to help clarify signals, and Apple has reportedly been researching its own RF technology for a few years now, so this could be a good prospective acquisition for Apple. We don't know if they are going to buy the company, but the rumors are that they are sniffing around, and if they do, The RF unit brought in about $2.2 billion in revenue during the fiscal quarter of 2019. That means the estimated price for Apple to acquire it could go as high as $10 billion. But considering the amount of cash that Apple has on hand, that is not very much to bring in, again, some additional engineering talent that could help with their internal efforts. So a few acquisitions and mergers coming up in the news this week. In a recent update to iOS, Apple added a pretty cool new feature into their parental controls, something they're calling Communications Limits. This feature allows parents to limit phone calls and texts on their child's devices to just people that are in their contacts. This is a feature that I had wanted for a while, and I think it's pretty great. Unfortunately, there seems to be a bug in the system related to iCloud syncing, and that bug could allow users to bypass the new feature. The feature also has the added advantage of preventing kids from being able to add contacts to their system, but that's actually where this bug comes into play, because the bug surfaces if the contacts are not stored in iCloud. So if you don't have iCloud syncing on along with the communication limit feature, your kids have the possibility to add additional users to contacts from unknown numbers. The way it works is if a text comes in from an unknown number, it is blocked as restricted by the communication controls as expected, and the text doesn't come in, but there also is an option presented that allows you to then add that unknown number to the contacts. Once that number is added to the contacts, it is then, of course, no longer restricted, and any future texts or phone calls from that number could come in to the device. It's also worth noting that Siri on the Apple Watch also can bypass these limits. So if you have Siri activated and an Apple Watch in combination with this, of course, your Apple Watch can make phone calls and receive texts, and that does also seem to bypass these new parental controls. Apple said in a statement that they are working on a fix for the bug, but they did not provide a timeline for when that might happen. Another thing that does seem to stop the bug from being able to be exploited is turning on downtime, which is the feature that would normally allow you to restrict access to certain apps during certain times of the day. This does seem to prevent the bug from happening, so this is a good workaround for any parents who might be concerned and still want to use the communication limits. So simply turning on downtime, I don't even think you have to set any specific downtime restrictions, just having that feature on will prevent this bug from happening. Of course, the other way around this would be to turn on iCloud syncing for the contacts, at least until Apple has a bug fix put out. We do know they are working on the next release version of iOS 13. We just got iOS 13.3, so I would imagine that this one goes into 13.4. Counterfeit iPhones are something that Apple has been dealing with, especially in China, since the original launch of the iPhone. They are fighting it on multiple fronts, but this week, Apple's business assurance and audit team had even more work to do because they are investigating a counterfeit ring that was selling iPhones made from rejected parts that were actually coming out of the Foxconn factories. That's the company that Apple uses for assembly of the iPhones in China. The information reportedly came from a whistleblower who emailed Tim Cook directly to report the fraud. There is a suggestion that the management team at Foxconn, responsible for destroying the defective parts, actually sold them to a crime ring who then assembled them into working devices and then sold them on to unsuspecting buyers. The scam supposedly has been happening over the past 3 years, and it's estimated to have brought in around $43 million US for the fraudsters, therefore also costing Apple about $43 million in potential sales. You may also remember that earlier in the year, Apple was scammed by two Chinese engineering students who allegedly imported non-functional counterfeit devices from China and then were taking them into Apple for warranty replacements. That scam cost Apple an estimated another $1 million US. And then there was a similar counterfeit scam reported later in the year that was run in Southern California by a couple of U.S. citizens who were born in China. That one cost Apple an estimated $6 million U.S. dollars. And then finally, there was a $19 million scam this year in New York, where a crime ring was using identity theft and stolen credit cards to go in, pose as cell phone subscribers to get new devices at little or no cost, and then turn around and sell those stolen phones on the black market. So it has been a pretty rough year for Apple in terms of trying to shut down counterfeit iPhone sales. Again, this isn't anything really new. They've been dealing with it for years, but it definitely does seem to be ramping up. And the fact that this time around it's coming from inside the house, basically Apple's own supplier Foxconn, that is a little bit disturbing and I would imagine frustrating for Apple. On the consumer side of things, I think especially this time of year, as people are looking to get deals on holiday gifts and whatnot, always it is buyer beware. Often if you come across a deal that seems too good to be true, you should be questioning it and make sure that you do your homework and try not to get scammed out there, because you know we all want new shiny Apple products for the holidays, but we do want the real thing. We all know that smartphone competition is tough out there, and Apple isn't always the largest seller of smartphones on the market. But one thing that's been going on for a few years now, actually for a long time, is the fact that while Apple doesn't sell the most, they do tend to get the lion's share of the revenue and the profits. And this year is no different. New estimates from Counterpoint Research show that regardless of market share, Apple is still the king at making money when it comes to selling iPhones. Their latest estimates are that Apple earns about 32% of total smartphone revenue and an impressive 66% of industry profits. To put things into perspective, Samsung takes second place with just 17% of industry profits. The report also does note that the total pool of smartphone money is in decline, with global smartphone profit dropping 11% year over year for the third quarter. Overall, the decline in smartphone profits in the last quarter is because premium smartphones are facing greater competition from mid-tier devices, especially less expensive ones coming out of Chinese manufacturers. Also, there is the lengthening upgrade cycle, where many people are just simply holding on to their phones for longer. So while the profits are declining, again, Apple does still seem to be maintaining the lion's share of the profits. I have to say that I have been really enjoying my free year subscription to Apple TV Plus. The shows that are on there have been great so far. I have been watching C and For All Mankind and Dickinson. Haven't gotten into the morning show yet, and I know that Apple has new shows coming on board like Savant, and also I believe I just saw a trailer for Little America, which is something that I was excited to see when it is released. But we know that also Apple, compared to some of the other services out there, has a smaller lineup of content, and they've been relying mostly on their original content so far for their service, and we haven't heard too much about them branching out beyond that. Well, this week, according to the Wall Street Journal, they say that Apple may be looking to change that. They claim that Apple met with both MGM Holdings and the Pac-12 conference to discuss future deals for Apple TV content. None of the deals are said to have really gone past the preliminary stages yet, but at least they are talking. With the Pac-12 conference, I would assume the idea is to have access to live streaming of college sporting events, which would be big for Apple and would really, I think, help them grow their new service quite nicely. With MGM, it's not really clear at this point what Apple is looking for, whether it would be new original content or access to MGM's massive back catalog of movies like the James Bond films. But either way, I think new original content or back catalog would go a long way to help Apple continue to grow and flesh out their new service. Apple is also continuing to grow their lineup of original in-house content, along with potentially making some new deals. Apple signed a recent first look deal with writer and actor Sharon Horgan. Horgan wrote the BBC comedy Motherland and also Women on the Verge. She is also known for the Emmy-nominated sitcom Catastrophe, which is on Channel 4 and on Amazon streaming, and Divorce on HBO. The duration of Apple's deal with Horgan is said to be, quote, multi-year, but there were no specific projects announced at this time, so it does look to be just simply a right of first refusal on any new writing stuff that she might be putting together. She also does some production through a production company, and that company is not part of this first look deal. But Apple, again, continuing to look to expand and grow Apple TV Plus content. A lot of people have been very critical about what Apple is doing in the space because they don't see them really competing against larger services like Amazon or Netflix or even the new Disney Plus. But Apple has been pretty upfront with the fact that that is not what they are trying to achieve. I really don't think internally they see themselves as being competitors or trying to compete with those services. I think, especially at the price point they have Apple TV Plus at now, and also with the free first year deal, I think they're really looking at just trying to be a additive service on top of those other services. Now, that's going to get harder and harder to do as time goes on and more of the streaming service industry becomes fragmented. We know that NBC is coming on board soon, so more and more, there's a lot of us that are having to pick and choose our services. For now, I think Apple is taking the right path, but they will eventually need to grow their content, and it's nice to see with these latest reports that they're certainly thinking about that stuff. Will they ever become as large as a Amazon or a Netflix? Only time will tell, but I think we can eventually get there. It's going to come down to how successful the service is in these early stages. What'll be really interesting is to see what happens this year when those free first-year subscriptions start to roll off, how many people re-up and resubscribe. And I think a big part of that is going to have to do with how much content Apple has in place by the time that date rolls around. So I would imagine we'll be seeing and hearing more and more about deals like this coming up as Apple tries to build up the new Apple TV Plus service. And then finally in the news for this week, could the next big thing for Apple be venturing into space? According to Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg, he thinks that might just be the next frontier for Apple. He claims that Apple has a small team of about a dozen engineers from the aerospace, satellite, and antenna design industries working on a new project for Apple. It's not really clear exactly what the project is, and as a matter of fact, the report oddly says that the team has the goal of deploying their results within 5 years, but that the group also has not yet come up with a clear direction or use case for satellites, and what they're going to be doing with them is not finalized. So it's interesting to have a hard goal of 5 years, but then to not really know what that goal is. I don't know how that really works out. So that was a little bit confusing to me. They also say, though, that Tim Cook has made this project a priority for the company. Supposedly, the main goal is to find new ways to send data to devices without the reliance of current cellular technologies. So that would assume that they're going to put satellites somehow into space and then beam data right down to our devices. We talked about this a little bit on the latest iOS show, if you want to check that out at theiosshow.com. And Michael Johnston, who is the host of that show, actually works now in the aerospace industry. He went to school to become an aerospace engineer, and he works on these things. And we had a pretty good discussion about the possibilities and the challenges. And 5 years would be a lofty goal. Let's just say that for this kind of technology in at least a smartphone. Again, it's not really clear exactly what Apple is working on, but battery levels and power and all these things come into play, and it would be a very, very big challenge if what they're really trying to do is get us off cellular networks, say, and move us into satellite data, basically satellite phones and those sorts of things. So we kind of thought maybe that's not exactly what they're working on. The report says also that they could be looking and exploring ways to provide more precise location tracking for devices, enabling improved maps or other new features. We talked about that as well, and that sort of feels unnecessary because the current GPS system is incredibly accurate. Apple already has access to that technology, and it wouldn't really make sense for them to have to kind of reinvent the wheel on that side of things. So I'd be curious to know if any of you out there are working in the satellite aerospace industry and maybe have your own speculation and thoughts on what Apple might be doing with this division. But certainly it's an area that they've been looking into for a while, because back in 2017, Apple did hire two Google executives, John Fenwick and Michael Trella, who worked over at Google on the company's satellite and spacecraft operations. When they were brought over to Apple, it wasn't really clear what they might be doing, but now in this report, it says that Fenwick and Trella are leading the team dedicated to satellites and related wireless technology. So again, Apple, when they get into these projects, they hire some of the best people in the industry to work on these things. So they are obviously very serious about this. Again, it's at this point, it's not really clear if Apple would actually be launching its own satellite systems into space or just making use of the technology via ground-based systems to send data to mobile devices. Certainly with the latter, they could find existing aerospace partners to work with and work with existing satellite systems that are maybe already deployed. So interesting to think about Apple moving into space as their next big thing. And we'll have to just wait and see if we hear more about what this group is up to through the rumor mill. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you this week about Text Expander. You know I am a huge fan of Text Expander. I've mentioned many times that it is something that I rely on day in and day out to get things done, especially with the podcast. As you might imagine, I get a lot of email from you. I have to deal with a lot of communication, and oftentimes I'm answering similar questions or the same question, and using Text Expander allows me to get through all those emails very efficiently and very quickly. I've built up a series of snippets over the years that help me answer your questions and respond to your emails. I can type out just a few quick letters and boom, it will expand out into an email. And I can even customize those emails because Text Expander has some great advanced snippet features where on execution, I can have fill-in fields. I can have optional text and data. I can even script those things with AppleScript or JavaScript. So you can make very, very powerful snippets. You can turn the things that you type every day into snippets and save time. You don't have to reinvent common email messages and replies every time you need them. You can store them in Text Expander instead. Companies also can benefit from Text Expander with Text Expander for Teams, for their customer support teams, for their reporting, for their email communications, anywhere where they need consistent and accurate text, Text Expander can help. And best of all, Text Expander snippets work anywhere. So whether you're working in Slack or Trello, Google Docs, inside the web browser, any place that you frequently type things, you can take advantage of Text Expander. And it's available on all your platforms. So it's not just macOS. It's also iPhone and iPad, but also Windows and even Chrome. So if you haven't taken a look at Text Expander yet, I encourage you to do so, especially now because show listeners, you get 20% off your first year. All you have to do is visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more about Text Expander and how it can save you time. You can also find out information on Text Expander for Teams so that you can deploy it to the teams in your office. Just visit textexpander.com/podcast. And a big thank you to Text Expander and Smile for their support of the podcast. So I wanted to have a discussion with you this week about A world in which a $50,000, $60,000 Macintosh exists. This came up on the last episode of MacCast. In the news, I told you that Apple is now shipping its amazing Mac Pro system, and it definitely is a system targeted at the hardcore professional. We're talking about Pixar, we're talking about Disney, we're talking about Adobe. Companies like that are the companies that Apple is really targeting this system for. Is it for a consumer? I guess if you have deep pockets, it definitely could be, but it's certainly starting at $6,000 is not for everyone. And as you start to custom configure it with additional storage, additional RAM options, the graphics, and all that sort of stuff, the price goes up exponentially very, very quickly. It is a modular system. It is an expandable system. It is meant to be something that you're going to have for a very long time. You could swap out all of the components, and we'll talk about that in a little bit because there's been some great teardowns by iFixit and some great reviews from some folks out there showing the potential of this system. But where I want to start this conversation is a $50,000 Mac ridiculous? It sounds like it on the surface. I think I mentioned in the last episode that I could either go out and buy a luxury car or a new Mac. And the choice seems pretty obvious to me as a consumer. But again, maybe if my business really depends on my ability to do computing at a very, very advanced high level, the cost seems to start to make sense. And I think really the answer to is having a $50,000 Mac ridiculous? The answer is it really depends, right? It depends on who you are. For most of us, absolutely. For a consumer, that is nuts. We're not going to need or require that sort of system. But for many true pros with very high-end applications like research science, 3D modeling, film and television production, photography, game development, maybe even some higher-end developers, yeah, those costs and prices do start to make sense. There's also some debate, though, about the value of the lower-end Mac Pro versus, say, something that's more prosumer-focused like the iMac Pro. And there has been a lot of analysis digging into the individual components and parts and the things that make up the Mac Pro that show that, at the very least, based on specs alone, the Mac Pro is at least as affordable, if not more affordable, than many similarly specced off-the-shelf PC workstations. Again, we're talking about workstations that are focused and pointed at the high-end professional market. And again, as we get deeper into this conversation, I want to remind you that what we're talking about here is an off-the-shelf professional workstation. We're not talking about a consumer prosumer level product like iMac Pro, and we're definitely not talking about a build-your-own PC where you're going to get off-the-shelf components, you're going to put together your own system. In that scenario, you can probably exceed the specifications of, say, a Mac Pro and come in at a better price, but you end up with sort of a Frankenstein system. And when we're talking about the Mac Pro, you're not going to have something building your own that's nearly as over-engineered or well-designed or well-thought-out as that system, right? You're talking about something that's pieced together with off-the-shelf components versus something that is custom designed and put together. It's sort of like buying a supercar, right, off the shelf versus building a car from scratch using different components, frame, body, engine that could actually outperform a supercar and be built for less of a price. Both things exist, both things are valid, but both things are very different when you're talking about what you're buying and the actual experience of using that day in and day out. So we're not talking about just raw performance. What we're trying to talk about comparing is what it would take to buy something off the shelf from a competitor versus what Apple has built and put in to the Mac Pro. I also think it's worth pointing out that a lot of the cost when you start going from that base model Mac Pro at $6,000 up to something in the $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 range, a lot of that stuff is coming into play with expensive add-on components. things like the 8 terabytes of flash storage or the 1.5 terabytes of high-end RAM. As a matter of fact, that RAM alone, that 1.5 terabytes coming from Apple, that's going to run you $25,000. And you might be saying, hey, I can get to 1.5 terabytes buying RAM from other suppliers, and it will be cheaper, and that is absolutely true. And with the Mac Pro, guess what? You can actually do that. You don't have to buy Apple's, you know, RAM that's really designed and built and spec'd and tested to be the best performing RAM that you can get in that system. You can go your own route, and you can definitely save money. Same thing on the graphics side. You can add your own graphics cards into your Mac Pro. The graphics cards that Apple sells, the Radeon Pro Vega 2 Duo cards, those are going to run you about $5,000 a piece. I think consumer off the shelf, they're actually $5,600. So you actually save a little bit of money going through Apple. Get two of those cards, and you're looking at another $10,000 on top of your base system, more than the base system itself. So, you know, RAM can cost more than the base system. Graphics cards can cost more than the base system. And again, that's what goes up to build this ridiculously high, you know, price tag on these machines. But again, if that is the kind of performance that you need, if that is the kind of, you know, fine tuning that you need, and you need something that you can go buy off the shelf, deploy into your company and get working and get productive immediately, that starts to make a lot of sense. That can start to generate revenue back and pay for itself in a relatively short time. So there's a lot of ways to actually justify that cost. And again, you may be able to find some cost savings by doing the upgrades yourself. And you can start with a base model and sort of go up from there. But getting back to sort of comparing what Apple is selling to other off-the-shelf workstations that you can buy from, say, companies like Dell or HP or Lenovo, Apple Insider actually did a little bit of digging, and they found that the Mac Pro, even in its base configuration, compares very well to some of its competitors. They spec'd out an HP, a Lenovo, and a Dell, similarly spec'd to the Mac Pro at its $6,000 starting price tag, and they found that those off-the-shelf PC systems came in right around the same price, and often only after they were offering extreme holiday rebates. And beyond that, a lot of the PCs were missing some critical components, things like Thunderbolt 3, dual gigabit Ethernet cards, and of course, none of them had the engineering and styling that the Mac Pro does. So it doesn't seem like Apple is out of the realm of reality when you start to look at what you get with the new Mac Pro. Now, I do think it is worth mentioning, especially when we're talking about the base model, that if you're looking at pure processor performance, pure Geekbench scores, most of Apple's consumer models, like the iMac Pro, are on par or can even outperform the base model Mac Pro when you're looking at single core processor performance. And when I say most of Apple's consumer models, yes, that even includes the 6-core i7 Mac Mini. It can out Geekbench the single core performance of the 8-core Mac Pro. And you're going to be paying a lot less for that Mac Mini. Now, when you start getting into multi-core performance, that's where the Mac Pro starts to take off against all the other consumer models that Apple makes, except for, well, and again, this is not a consumer model, but except for the iMac Pro. When it comes to multi-core, the 8-core iMac Pro actually edges out the 8-core Mac Pro. And keep in mind, that is just CPU, not counting everything else that comes with the machine. Now, I think also because of how it's tuned and with the display, the iMac Pro also tends to outperform the base model Mac Pro when it comes to GPU performance. But it's important to remember with the Mac Pro, most of those Pro systems are going to be custom configured beyond the base configuration for the kinds of applications you're talking about. But when you're looking at, you know, the purchase, do I buy a $5,000 iMac Pro or do I buy a $6,000 Mac Pro? I think what this shows is you really need to start to think about what your applications are and how important expansion and future upgradability is. Because with the iMac Pro, that's going to be much more difficult. You can get in there and you can upgrade the flash storage. You can get in there and you can upgrade the processor. But opening that machine up is much more difficult than the simplicity of just twisting the handle and lifting off the case on the Mac Pro. And with the Mac Pro, you can get to almost every component to do your upgrades, even without tools. It's a pretty amazing design. So if what you're looking to do is get a prosumer level system, something that's going to grow, something that you're going to have upgradability with, something that you're going to be able to easily pop other graphics cards in, paying that extra $1,000 on the base model, even knowing that up front you might be getting slightly less performance, that might be a better value for you. If you're just looking for something that you can drop off the shelf and start working with today's current technology, and you're looking to save a little bit of money, the iMac Pro might be a better choice. And you also have to remember with the iMac Pro, you're getting an amazing 5K display built in, one of the best on the market. To add that to your Mac Pro, especially if you're going with Apple's Pro Display XDR, you're looking at another $6,000 on top of your original $6,000 investment. So it's kind of a big deal. Of course, you can get another 5K monitor for much cheaper, something like the LG version or the LG monitor that Apple sells to go with your Mac Pro and maybe save a little bit of money. But again, these are all considerations to take into effect when you're looking at what you need a Pro system for, what you're going to be doing with it. The Mac Pro's 8 terabyte storage option did come out this week. I mentioned a little bit earlier, you're going to pay a premium for that. It's another $2,600 on top of the base model. Again, if you need that much built-in internal storage, you can get it from Apple, but you can also add that on later. And there's a bunch of different options for that. I think Promise is now selling some really cool new RAID modules that can go right inside your case. And that's really where the Mac Pro shines. And that's why you're paying that premium price, is for that expandability, for that upgradability. And it definitely is no slouch. When we're talking about these Geekbench numbers and saying some of Apple's consumer level systems in the, you know, in their configurations for a cheaper price can beat out that base model Mac Pro, we're saying that, but it's important to remember those systems are sort of locked in time and they're not going to grow and expand in the same way that the Mac Pro is. So there is a reason to be paying that premium price if that's the kind of feature that you need. So getting back to the original question, is a $50,000 Mac ridiculous? Again, it really depends. I don't think that it is. I think it makes sense for the marketplace. It has its place in the market. And it's great that Apple has finally come back to a full continuum of products in their lineup. Something to suit the consumer at the low end all the way up to the extreme pro user. They have a model, they have a configuration that can work for you, and they have everything in between. And I think that's the important thing to remember, because some people and some reporting has kind of gone crazy looking at the Mac Pro and not really pointing out, you know, which segment of the market that is for. You know, they're trying to show that, hey, this is something ridiculous for consumers to buy, and that is absolutely correct. But again, as we know, that's not the target market. One other thing that I want, a couple other things that I want to talk about with the Mac Pro that just came up this week, some additional kind of news items. The Mac Pro did get a teardown from iFixit, and I thought this was pretty cool because very often when we get teardowns from iFixit with Apple products, they get very low repairability scores, usually in the 1 to 2 range. I think you might not find it surprising that the Mac Pro got a 9 out of 10. iFixit noted very few or no tools required to do most of the upgrades. Another nice feature is that inside the RAM covers, so they have some covers that go over your DIMM modules to help direct airflow. When you pop those off, and there's a little latch for doing that, inside that cover, they actually have diagrams that show you how to populate your memory to optimize the performance and how everything slots into the various slots, which is really, really handy. So right there, you don't need to grab another manual or go online to look up instructions. They also noted that the SSDs are modular, just like in the iMac Pro, but Apple did get dinged a little bit for upgradability there because those SSD modules are paired to the T2 chip. So you can't just go out and get a new SSD module and pop it in yourself. You're actually going to have to go through an Apple or an Apple authorized service provider to get those repaired with the T2 chip that is inside your system. And Apple requires a special tool and software to be able to do that. And that is only available to Apple or Apple authorized resellers. So even if you can buy the modules, you are going to have to jump through that extra hoop to get them installed. And then one other thing that I want to discuss, just because it was kind of a big deal, especially here in the United States, we do know that Apple is manufacturing Mac Pros at a facility in Austin, Texas. So they are made in the U.S. As the Mac Pros started to get shipped out worldwide, though, many Mac Pro owners in Europe started to notice that their computers are actually assembled and manufactured in China. They're being manufactured by Apple's partner Quanta, and I think that makes sense because of just regions, right? Getting it manufactured closer to where it's going to be shipping is going to provide some cost savings and some convenience, and so it's not surprising that Apple is doing that. It's just something to note because it seemed like they were all going to be made in the U.S., and that's turning out not to be the actual case. So just in closing, I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions on this. Are you excited about the Mac Pro, especially if you are a professional user? Maybe you're working at a company that's going to be picking up some Mac Pros. I know we have people that are in the film industry who listen to the podcast, also people who are in science and research. Is the Mac Pro going to be a game changer? Is this something that you've been waiting for? I believe that it is, but I'd love to get some direct feedback from you. So what do you think about the Mac Pro? What do you think about the pricing? Do you think it's ridiculous? Do you think I'm wrong in sort of my analysis that it actually is competitive? Maybe you can point out some instances where I missed something. So if you have a thought or opinion, send me a comment, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. I have to tell you, if you're looking for something to do over the holidays and you don't have an Apple Arcade subscription yet, I am absolutely still loving my subscription. It's a great time of year to actually have an Apple Arcade subscription because you might be traveling, need some things to do to pass the time while you're on the plane, or maybe I just have extra time. You know, I'm often so busy working, I don't have a lot of time for games, but over the holidays I'm relaxing and it's nice to be able to pop in and just have this large collection of things that you can look into, you can try out, you can play. As a matter of fact, Jeff Gamet just told me this week about the awesome new puzzle game, Lego Builder's Journey. I'm a Lego fan. I love puzzle style games. This one kind of has almost like a Monument Valley kind of feel to it. And I'm quite enjoying that, although I've just started playing it. But the fact that I have my Apple Arcade subscription means I'm not paying any extra for that. I can just pop on to that section of the App Store and boom, there is a plethora of games that I have to enjoy. I'm also enjoying games like Where Cards May Fall, The Guildlings, Grindstone, and I've been playing with my daughter Cat Quest 2 on the Apple TV, and that is great using a couple of controllers. I have a PS4 controller, Bluetooth controller, and a Nimbus Steel Series controller, and it really does kind of turn the Apple TV into a console. I'm not going to say it's anything that can compete with, say, like a Nintendo Switch. I still kind of think I would like one of those. Maybe that'll show up under the tree this holiday season. We'll have to wait and see. But certainly for casual games, for even kind of some more non-casual games, Apple Arcade is quite a nice option. And right now, you can actually save about $10 a year by doing a yearly subscription. Apple just released a yearly option. So normally it's $4.99 a month US. You can now pay for the full year up front. That means it's just about $4.17 a month versus the $4.99. And if you've already subscribed to Apple Arcade, you can actually switch your account. And it's pretty easy. And what will happen is it will basically cancel your monthly after the current month you're in and then start you up on the yearly billing with your next billing cycle. So all you have to do to switch is go into settings, tap on your account, tap on subscriptions, and then tap your current monthly subscription. And then there you can change your plan over to the yearly option and save some additional money. So I thought this was a great little tip if you want to save $10 a year on your Apple Arcade subscription. There's also right now, if you're not an Apple Music subscriber, apparently a pretty good deal where you can try out Apple Arcade or Apple Music rather for up to 6 months for free. I just read about this and I thought I'd share it with you. Apparently, if you download the Shazam app on your iOS device, you can get some additional free months of Apple Music for signing up. And this was first spotted by Macworld UK. Again, all you have to do is go into the App Store, download the Shazam app, open it up, tap on the library button in the top left corner, and then inside there you should see the promotion for a free Apple Music subscription, and tap on that, and then when you sign up for the Apple Music offer, you can get up to 6 months. Now, Macworld UK noted that they were offered 6 months free. Macworld in the US only got a 4 month offer, but that's still better than the one free month that Apple typically gives you for signing up. And I'm already an Apple Music subscriber, so this offer is for new Apple Music subscriptions, but the piece did note that if you're already an Apple Music subscriber, you wouldn't normally see the offer, but there were some reports saying that you could cancel your current Apple Music subscription, then go through the Shazam app, and you would get offered a three-month free trial. Say that five times real fast. And you could get back into an Apple Music subscription with a couple months for free. I'm not going to do that. I'm happy with my Apple Music subscription. I still think it's a great deal at $10 a month. Actually, we have the family plan, so it's $15 a month for me. But I love Apple Music. This promo does last, apparently, until December 31st. So if you've been thinking about trying out Apple Music and you want to get a couple of extra months for free, try going through the Shazam app, and you might be able to get some additional time to try the service out. Of course, with the holidays here, something you might be doing quite a bit of is taking photos and videos with your iPhone. And one of the things you might want to do is play around with the slow motion features. As a matter of fact, Apple has a holiday ad right now that was completely shot and edited, I believe, on an iPhone 11 Pro. And they highlight some of the slow motion capabilities of the iPhone in sort of making kind of cool holiday videos. And so you might be inspired by that. It might be something that you want to do. But I received an email this week from a listener, Rod, who ran into a bit of trouble with using the slow-mo feature, specifically with editing. And not so much trouble, but something that was a little bit concerning. He found a bug and he wanted to let us all know about it and share what he discovered. So here's what Rob had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Rod. I'm currently traveling in Hawaii and thought of you and your listeners when I discovered a bug in iOS 13.3 with regards to slow-mo photography. I really enjoy capturing the waves and many of the things moving here in Hawaii using slow-mo. And now we have the ability in iOS 13 to edit also for color, saturation, tint, etc. So what I discovered is that when you go to the media folder after you've taken some slow-mo videos and you begin to edit a slow-mo video, everything goes as normal. You can trim where you want the slow-mo to happen when the wave crashes, for example. And you can go into the edit function, color, etc. Make it nice. The video will begin to save the changes that you've made, and then it will suddenly disappear, and you'll be looking at the next video in line. It can be an extreme panic if the slow-mo that you took was something treasured and difficult to replace. And I found some threads online that referred to the video being deleted permanently, which is what it appeared had happened. It wasn't in my recently deleted folder, etc. But on further investigation, I discovered that when I go through the timeline of my photos and the recent photos, all the thousands of photos I have, if I go through and find the actual video, it's actually there with the edits. What seems to be happening is the slow-mo tag is removed when any, I don't know how many edits are made, but at certain points, when you do an edit on a slow-mo video and you're not trimming it to save it as new, but you are actually just editing the video you have, it removes the slow-mo tag, and then you're not able to see it in the slow-mo folder, and your quantity of slow-mo videos reduces by one. So I wanted to let you and your listeners know, in case there's a lot of family videos, slow-mo videos happening this holiday season, and they don't want, so they don't feel like that treasured moment is lost.
Hey, Rod, thank you for sending that in, because I do think that could potentially cause a panic for a few people. I will let you know that the voicemail, Rod left a little bit more talking about how he works around this issue for now. Unfortunately, my voicemail system cuts off at about 3 minutes, so the message got cut short. But basically what he said was that what he does now is either duplicate the slow-mo video or favorite it first, so that when he makes the edits, he can go back and easily find that video. And by doing the duplicate, what's nice is that means that the original slow-mo video will stay in that slow-mo section in your albums, and just the edited version will move into the main library. So what's going on here, just in case it wasn't clear, and I did confirm this bug on my iPhone 11 Pro, what seems to happen is when you take any action in editing a video, a slow-mo video, that would cause it to resave. So you can go in and change the sliders to where the slow-mo starts, and that doesn't seem to trigger this problem. But if you go in and make a trim, or you do a color correction, or you do any other kind of edit that would cause it to resave the video, it will take it out of the slow-mo album section. So when you go into albums, you scroll down under media types, you have things like selfie and slow-mo as an option. What we're talking about is that slow-mo category. Normally when you take a slow-mo video, it will show up in there. If you go in and then edit that video and trigger this bug, you'll no longer find that video in the slow-mo section. It's suddenly like it's not a slow-mo video anymore, even though it still is. And when you find it any place else in your album, say in your main library, even when you go in to edit it, you can still edit the slow-mo information, do all that stuff. But like Rod said, it seems like it just loses that tag. It loses whatever designation Apple has to let it know that it is of a slow-mo media type. And I don't know if there's any actual way to restore that. So if you want to duplicate your video before editing it, it's relatively easy. You just select the slow-mo video, you tap the share button, and then you should have a duplicate option. And then you can then work with the duplicated version to do any of your edits, and then still, like I said, save that slow-mo video into the slow-mo section. But I could imagine it could create quite a panic for a lot of people. If you shot the slow-mo video, you thought it was in the slow-mo section, you go back to find it, and suddenly it's not there anymore, right? It does feel like it's deleted, and if you do have a large library, it might not be that easy to find that video again. So thank you, Rod, for sending in this tip. I'm sure that's going to avoid a lot of frustration for a lot of people over this holiday season, and I appreciate that. So thank you for your voicemail. And then finally, for the show for this week. I do have a question from Julius, who wrote in and was wondering about saving voice messages inside the Messages app in iOS 13. And what we're talking about is the messages that you send when you tap on the little voice icon, record your voice, and then send that to another person, right? You can send a little audio message, and then the person receives it. They can listen to it inside the Messages app. Normally, sort of out of the box, the default behavior is that those messages would delete in 2 minutes unless you change the settings. But you used to also have the ability to save those messages. So when you tap and hold on the received message, you get the pop-up that has an option that says save. And when you tap on that save button, you would assume it saves it somewhere. But when you do it in iOS 13 now, nothing seems to happen. And I did confirm this on my iPhone. Now, prior to iOS 13 and iOS 12, I believe the files would actually get saved into the voice memo application. But Julius mentioned in his email that since iOS 12, the voice memos app or feature was removed, so there's no place for it to save. Julius, actually, for the record, the Voice Memos app still does exist on iOS after iOS 12, but you actually need to download and install it from the App Store. It's just not installed or included by default anymore since iOS 12. So you can go and install it, and I actually have the Voice Memos app on my iPhone, but when I tried tapping and saving an audio message from Messages, I experienced the same problem you did. It did not go anywhere. It did not save it into the Voice Memos app, even though I have it installed. So that functionality appears to be broken or not working. It's not really clear. The only thing I can think of is maybe the save option, by tapping that, it would override the default delete option, where it would delete it after 2 minutes normally. But generally, that's a setting you just change, and that's how that's controlled. So Julius's question was, if this isn't working, how do I save these audio messages? And for me, the only workaround I could figure out, Julius, was instead of tapping the save option from that dialog, so tapping and holding on the voice message in the Messages app, instead of tapping save, I tapped copy to copy the message. Then I opened up the Files app, went to a directory where I wanted to save it. In my case, I use the desktop and document syncing. So I just went into my Documents folder, created an audio folder or a message audio messages folder, and then tapped paste inside that folder. And that did end up pasting the audio file into my iCloud drive. It actually gave me a core audio file, and I could play that on my iOS device. It's a .caf file, so it's Apple Core audio file format. And that allowed me to save it out that way. And then with iCloud syncing, I could actually go on my Mac. It would actually play on my Mac natively, running macOS Mojave. I would assume any recent version of the Mac operating system. And then if you want it in a more compatible format, you can go in and open it up in QuickTime, choose File, Export As Audio Only, and save it out as an MPEG-4 audio file, an M4A audio file. So you could save them out that way. I did not figure out any other way to be able to save those messages. And so we're going to kind of throw it out to the audience. If you know a way to actually save them differently from Messages, let us know about it. Shoot us an email or an audio comment. Julius, I will also assume that you went into your Messages settings and changed that setting so that your audio messages won't auto-delete after 2 minutes. In case you didn't, like I said, by default, iOS will only keep audio messages sent inside the Messages app for 2 minutes. You have to change the setting. You open up Settings, you go into the Messages settings, and then under Audio Messages, tap on the expire options and change the setting from after 2 minutes to never. And that way it will always keep your audio messages at least inside the Messages app. And then maybe you can use this copy trick to actually save off individual messages if you want to keep them longer or keep them someplace else. And while you're in those settings, you may also want to adjust just your general message history, because again, messages are set to auto-delete after a certain amount of time. That's under the Keep Messages setting, and the options there are 30 days, 1 year, or forever. So a lot of people like to have their text messages around and don't want them auto-deleted, so you might want to double-check and make sure your setting is set appropriately. And then as far as saving off the audio messages, there was actually one other method I could think of, and I did try this out, and it's one of my favorite tools for managing my iPhone on my Mac, and that is iMazing. You can go into iMazing. iMazing has the ability for you to be able to back up and save all of your audio, all of your messages. You can actually save them out as text files. You can save them out as PDF files. You can also save out all of your attachments inside Messages on your Mac using iMazing. And I was able to, again, save out the audio file in that core Apple Core audio file format from the iMazing application. So you can go into the messages inside there and save out those audio messages. Again, I'd love to know if there is any kind of native iOS way to do this anymore. Again, in the past, I believe you could get them into audio messages, so I don't know if this is just simply a bug in iOS at the moment. It seems like it's been around since iOS 12, though, so it's hard to believe that this feature might not be working for that long, but I wouldn't put it past Apple to simply have this bug on the list, and because it's not super critical and probably not something a lot of people really use, they just haven't addressed it yet. But hopefully they will eventually fix it. If you are frustrated by this problem, I would recommend sending feedback to Apple using the apple.com/feedback URL and let them know you would like to have this bug fixed. It feels to me like you should be able to tap save and then select something in your iCloud drive, a place in your iCloud drive, to simply save that file. That feels to me like the right way for it to work if it's not automatically going into the Voice Memos app. And it doesn't seem to make sense for it to do that anymore, since Voice Memos is not a default app that's installed on the operating system anymore. But thank you for your email. And if anybody in the community does get back to us and lets us know a different way for managing those audio messages, I will certainly share that on a future episode of the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before we move on, I do want to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or maybe you have the answer for Julius, send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me online on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. But that is going to do it for now. Happy holidays. Hope you have a wonderful and safe holiday season. I should have another podcast out before the end of the year, but in case you don't hear me by then, also have a great and happy and safe new year, and we'll see you in 2020. But there is, again, still one more episode of the MacCast coming, so if you do get that in your feed, you might have something for the trip home from your holiday break. That will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.